Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is the period of the utilitarian liberal, not of the Democrat. It's 1850, and in the Cape, a newly minted constitution had been drafted by the Attorney General William Porter. This was based on a non-racial qualified franchise. All adult males who had occupied property worth at least £25 for a year were eligible to vote. Porter had toiled on the draft of this document for the newly minted governor, Sir Harry Smith, who'd sent it to London. Later in 1850, Porter, though, had a complete change of heart, as utilitarian liberals tend to do. He denounced the option of universal suffrage, at least for men of all colours, as threatening to the colony, with, in his words, its communism, socialisms, and red republicanisms, which had caused so much mischief in France. There had been an attempted major communist revolution in France in 1848, which had spilled over into other parts of Western Europe, including the land that would become known as Germany. This horrified utilitarians everywhere, no less so than in the Cape Colony. As the ship bearing Smith's new constitution headed north, another was heading south and crossed each other somewhere out there in the wild, untamed ocean. It was a dispatch from Colonial Secretary Earl Grey, who proposed sending Irish convicts to the Cape. Smith announced this proposal to the horrified residents of Cape Town, who immediately aroused a storm of agitation against the governor. The settlers had been considering representative government for some time, and this suggestion of Irish convicts in the Cape backfired, driving many more of the moderate thinkers into the arms of those who were agitating for some form of independent governance. The colonists regarded the Irish as a threat to their respectability, and citizens used the concept as a weapon to attack the oligarchy that ran the Cape at this time. It was a legislative council nominated by governors, not elected by the people, so it had been tainted constantly by allegations of corruption, nepotism, and a host of other maladies associated with power wielded too long by men who were mostly too greedy. The convicts duly arrived on a ship called Neptune, but they were refused entry to Cape Town, and the men sat in chains in Simon's Bay for 5 months. Eventually, in 1850, the ship was ordered to sail away. One of the main antagonists in this crazy story was a man called John Montague. He had been alarmed by how the Irish convict idea had radicalized even his mild-mannered friends, and so he demanded that Smith reimpose some kind of authority and stop this movement towards representative government. Montague argued that the whole idea was anti-English, not what the British should be supporting, so Smith delayed the implementation. But what was going on was very, very interesting. The hullabaloo had revealed two very distinct political movements inside the Cape. One was conservative, pro-English and pro-British government led by Montague, joined by the big merchants of Cape Town. They were also joined by the Eastern Cape settlers led by their flag-bearer, Grahamstown Journal editor and land speculator Robert Godlinton. Another powerful figure joined this conservative echelon, and that was the newly arrived Anglican bishop, Robert Grey. A newspaper called The Monitor was launched in October 1850 by these conservatives. The second political movement were the Radicals, both British and Afrikaner, led by John Fairbairn, Christoffel Brandt, Francis Willem Reitz, and Andries Stockenstrom. They regarded the Conservatives as a corrupt bunch of nepotists and oligarchy, but they were divided by what to do about frontier policy. Fairbairn used his newspaper, the South African Advertiser, to defend the rights of blacks, while Brandt preferred to defend the rights of the Dutch descendants against the oppression of old English money elites. Stockenstrom had his own varied approach to both. Brandt was a fascinating character. Born in 1797, as the Dutch East India Company's power came to an end, he came from a long line of Dutch colonial administrators in the Cape. His father and grandfather had been officials of the VOC. After being educated in Cape Town, Brandt obtained a doctorate in law at the University of Leiden in 1820, with a dissertation on the relationship that colonies have to their mother country, called Dissertatio Politico Juridica de Jure Colonarium, translated from Latin as A Political Legal Dissertation on the Law of Colonies. He also earned a doctorate of letters with the thesis Questiones in Socrates Sententiam de Deo, or Questions on Socrates' Opinion about God. He returned to the Cape in 1821, established a law practice in Cape Town, and immediately became interested in local politics. He was one of the founders of the Zuid Afrikaans Athenaeum in 1828, South Africa's first university for Dutch-speaking students, and was one of the first advocates in the Supreme Court in 1829. He also founded the Zuid Afrikaan newspaper, and as its editor, he championed the Dutch language in his editorials. Like many others, he had hoped that the English would continue to deploy the Dutch at high levels of government, and he became bitterly disillusioned by the manner in which he perceived a British government having marginalized the Cape Dutch community. His main gripe was the way in which the British had replaced the Dutch legal system in the colony with an Anglophone common law system. It was this that radicalized the young lawyer, and along with John Fairbairn, he campaigned for representative government and supported the anti-Irish convict movement. For Brandt, the main problem was the growing dilution of the Dutch in numbers compared to the other colonists arriving in the Cape. Adding the Irish into this mix was unacceptable. Church-going at this time was one of the main focuses of social contact, but British sectarianism was reinforced in the Cape's heterogeneous society. Surrounded by the Dutch Calvinist observance, there were 19 additional mutually hostile denominations and sects, ranging from Catholicism through Anglicanism to a vigorous nonconformism, whose ranks included the elite. Then, of course, there were the Muslims of the Cape and the Jews. The latter were regarded as part of the settler group, provided they were wealthy enough. The former were not. Freed slaves were now running successful businesses, and many were regarded as competitors by the English and the Dutch. The first mosque was only going to be built in the Cape in the 1850s, but the adherents had been practicing their religion throughout the period of colonization, from the time of the first slaves who arrived in 1652, along with the first Dutch. The Malays of Batavia, as they were called. Sheikh Abdullah, who was the son of Abdul al-Aziz of Mecca, had arrived in the Cape on a commercial venture, then ended up marrying a local woman and remained in the colony. When the British banned slavery in the Cape, Muslims emerged to worship publicly. Because the Dutch had avoided educating their slaves, most naturally took to Islam in the vacuum. S.A. Rochlin published a brilliant analysis of this in his paper entitled Aspects of Islam in 19th Century South Africa. That's to be found in the 1939 edition of the Bulletin of the School of Oriental Studies at the University of London. Rochlin noted that the slave owners and then the British preferred to have workers of this persuasion in their wine cellars. Islamic spiritual leaders arrived in the Cape regularly with names like Frans van Bengalan, Ahmed van Arabia, and Ahmed van Bengal. The head mullah, who administered the Cape Muslims up until the mid-19th century, was sent from the upper provinces of Bengal in India. So, in the far east of the Cape Colony, in what Smith had renamed British Kaffraria, the Amakhosa were contained within territory that was apparently irretrievably lost. And unlike previous centuries, there was no prospect of territorial expansion in any direction. Sandile's Amanika people were the most fortunate. They managed to remain in their traditional home in the Amatola Mountains, while Mhalas and Nhlambe and Patatkunukwebe were living closer to the coast. The territory was demarcated and named after British counties like Cambridge, Lincoln, Sussex, Yorkshire, and so on, and characterized by a mixture of forts. Taking charge of the British Kaffrarian administration was Lieutenant Colonel George McKinnon, the Chief Commissioner and Commander of all forces from his HQ in King William's Town. Two other British officials were key, apart from McKinnon, who I'll get back to in a minute. They were Captain John McLean, an imperial duty man, a perfect example of an English military man of this period, and Charles Brownlee. McKinnon was steeped in the stories of military derring-do. His father, Major General Henry McKinnon, was hailed as an honest-to-goodness British hero killed during the storming of the Ciudad Rodrigo whilst fighting Napoleon with Wellington. By 1824, McKinnon Jr. had purchased his lieutenant colonelcy in the Grenadier Guards, serving in North America, then through the 1830s ended up as a part-time soldier. He was recalled into service by Earl Grey, the Secretary for War in the Colonies, and was totally unprepared for what he was going to face in South Africa. His incompetence as a soldier appeared to have been matched by his administrative mediocrity. Captain McLean, the second person of interest in this British Kaffraria saga, was a hot-headed Scotsman whom Harry Smith fancied as the most attractive of all officers. The Amakosa called him the Constable of Our Enemies, so you can tell from their point of view he left a lot to be desired. McLean, however, was also one of the few officers who doled out discipline to both black and white. He disliked to carry out capital offences on whites, that is true, but he made sure that an English soldier who threw a koi koi prostitute into a river faced the death penalty. He was a man of Pax Britannica, attentive, methodical, cold, a man of significance. Then our third English player in this Eastern Cape drama, John Brownlee, was altogether a very different character from the first two. He'd grown up with Amakosa youths, fluent in isiXhosa, unlike McKinnon and McLean. Brownlee was a big man, serious and right-minded, justice-inclined, if you like, representing the other type of colonial and imperial person. He was immersed in the way of the Xhosa and the son of a missionary. He had been brought up inside Amakosa society and yet had the tendency to try to turn what he called a barbarous people to the way of civilization. Unlike the other two, John Brownlee could spend his days travelling alongside his Amakosa friends, bush travelling, sitting around fires, listening to the reminiscences of Xhosa warriors. Battles that Brownlee had fought in on the English side, the light of the fires revealing mock anger when they discovered places they had fired on each other. Historians like Noel Mostert believe Brownlee used these relationships as political research, as sources of information. He used them to incriminate chiefs later and to capture cattle thieves. A paternal father figure, misguided, but convoluted, not contrived. He was contradictory, complex. These three English administrators were part of Governor Harry Smith's plan to subjugate the Amakosa. After almost a century of war between the Dutch and other English, seven major episodes of armed confrontation, the Amakosa had gradually but inevitably lost much of their land, and now they were brought under full British authority as subjects. The fact that Smith had been implicit in the murder of Amakosa chief Hintze should have disqualified him from the post of governor. The dangers of placing such a man in charge of Hintze's people and his determination to follow through with his mentor Sir Benjamin Durban's project, his system in the Eastern Cape, led him to draw up his own formula. It was a formula that was going to lead to failure and colonial disaster. Smith was reinforcing a brutal transformation of Amakosa culture I've spoken about in previous episodes. Of course, the transformation was happening on a landscape that is curious in its uniqueness. Unlike the last few hundred years, the Amakosa could no longer wander about, moving to wetter places when the rain stopped. Water decides the patterns of occupation, how people flow across the southern African region, and how they have over thousands of years. Climate is like the director of history, waving its arms about, yelling, "Cut, cut, take two." South Africa is perhaps drier than most people realize, because the country's natural condition is parched, arid, semi-desert. The entire Southern African region's annual rainfall is less than the world's average rainfall. Evaporation is high. 91% of the rain that falls disappears, never to reach a river. Less than a tenth of the land in South Africa can be cultivated without irrigation. The Amakosa had arrived at the southernmost edge of this climate, and before the agriculture could emerge from the cultural determinants, their route south was cut by the colonists moving north. By mid-1800, the 1850s, their deeply conservative attachment to an ancient culture grappling with new ways amplified the coming disaster. The modest agriculture they practiced and their pastoral existence along the coastal shelf was in danger. Previously abundant game that had been available when the dry took hold were gone. Their land was also gone. The British had won most of the previous wars by burning Xhosa stocks of grain. By the mid-1800s, the style of Amakosa agriculture could not cope with the slash-and-burn military tactic. The Amakosa barely tilled the soil. They broke it with wooden or little iron-tipped hoes. They needed to change to a more advanced technique to build bigger grain stores so that they could fight the British properly. But they did not. And now the land speculators from the Cape and Natal were snapping up every piece of land they could across the Orange River and into British Kaffraria. This, of course, was a general picture. Many Amakhosa had, in fact, begun to use oxen to plough using new iron ploughs, deepening their furrows, tapping their rivers and streams, allowing more types of crops all year round. However, most Amakhosa viewed the missionaries' ploughs in the same way they viewed the missionaries, as bringers of their own destruction, emblematic, implicit in the theft of their land. They were clinging very tightly to what was really an out-of-date concept. They preferred riding their oxen in races than using them to till the fields. Some chiefs said ploughing made the oxen sick, too thin, too weak. Then a minority at first realized that developing farmland was empowerment. More about this fascinating group of people through the next episodes. Sir Harry Smith wanted the Amakhosa to forget their ways, and for the British governor, they represented an immediate source of labor. When dubious missionary Henry Calderwood began seizing Amakhosa women and children and sending them to the Cape as labor, even Smith was uneasy at first. "Is this legal?" he asked in a pencil note on one of his dispatches. Calderwood had told Smith, before they sent this letter off to London, that "the women will be as useful as the men, and many of the children will soon be useful." Terrifyingly off-handed, simplistic, self-serving, wretched to our ears in the 21st century. Smith's pace was extempore. He wanted to wave his colonial wand over the Amakhosa, or perhaps, as most suggest, over the whole of South Africa, driven by a feverish desire to quickly deliver improvements, after which he could shout, "Presto, they're done," and be granted his order of the British Empire. And then, as if by magic, the missionaries appeared to believe in the same dark quirks of immediacy. Scots missionary Robert Niven, who had warned Smith earlier about taking Amakhosa land and was regarded as sympathetic to them, turned this into a messianic message. "Smith," announced Niven, "had been called by Providence," and followed that jaw-dropping presumption with his own version of the change of Amakhosa speed record. "It is not a problem to force change suddenly," said Niven, "because the time had come to save time. 1 month now is worth a generation," he solemnly wrote. A whole new world could arise immediately. They believed that encapsulated in Smith's power was the power of God, believing that "as the word of him who is light shines more in the country, so it may be expected that the results contemplated and desired by the High Commissioner will be witnessed." Smith was trying to usher in a cultural revolution through a revolution in agriculture. As the administrators and the missionaries hailed the plan, others regarded the cost as astronomical. Who exactly was going to pay for these new ploughs and seed? The biggest headache, however, was irrigation. This, as anyone who knows anything about farming in South Africa, is expensive. Thus my comments earlier about the climate. Just as an example, in the late 1830s, Scots missionaries had built a 2-mile-long waterway 10 feet deep to feed their farms in the ceded territory. That cost them over £100, a fortune. Even MacKinnon, now Smith's chief commissioner of British Kaffraria, pointed out that the idea was too expensive. "Education," said the commissioner, "was the key, not farming." His idea was novel. Why not use economics in business? British Kaffraria earned revenue by selling licenses to settlers to open trading stores inside the region. These cost £50 a year, and there were at least 38 of these stores across the territory. Each store had its own small holding. If the goods they sold the colonists and the Amakhosa could be taxed 5%, with beads at 12%, the tax could be spent on upgrading towns near Amakhosa villages. By now, British Kaffraria was the only military colony in the entire British Empire, across the globe. Because it was a military colony, MacKinnon ruled it through martial law, a firm military authority. However, Smith had instructed MacKinnon to rule the territory through the medium of the chiefs. Yet Smith had declared himself the paramount chief, thus upending the concept of Amakhosa chiefly power. MacKinnon instituted his own British military law, arbitrary, biased, and ethical. And here was the crux of this crumbly biscuit. What was going on in 1848, 1849, 1850 was that British Kaffraria was a colony without law. For the first time in their history, the Amakhosa had suspended their own ancient system of justice based on fines and cattle. These fines were now paid in cash to Mackinnon at King Williamstown. Chaos ensued. From this chaos, another kind of millenarian movement was to emerge, led by Nkqawuse, a troubled young teen girl, a medium. An extraordinary tale, and a story of warning for anyone who follows leaders they think are anointed by God. Only pain and catastrophe await folks who switch off their logic and reasoning, blindly adhering to magic. It is a terminal illness that humans suffer from. What happened next is for next episode. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platform. It helps elevate its visibility. You can head off to desmondlatham.blog, where I'm going to load an update about this episode and also register for my little newsletter there. Until next, Salayatli.